stories of the nation's exploits. Through Reginald, Malcolm discovered that three more of his siblings, Filbert, Wesley, and Hilda, had joined the group. Malcolm's sister Ella knew Elijah Muhammad and his wife Clara from her time in Georgia, where the couple had resided before joining the nation. For the Little family, politics was a family affair, and Malcolm soon joined the NOI while still in prison. In jail, 21-year-old Malcolm found his first intimate positive male role models since Earl's death. The most important of these came through the Nation of Islam, which had come of age in the political space created by the decline of Garveyism. The Nation innovated a messianic vision of racial pride, dignity, and self-determination that had found a beachhead in the economic misery of the Great Depression. Elijah Poole, a semi-literate former Georgia sharecropper, refashioned himself as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Allah's messenger, who held the key to black liberation. The nation's eclectic philosophy combined aspects of black nationalism, pan-Africanism, and religious mythology to preach a version of Islam that identified whites as the creation of a misguided black scientist named Yaqub. Blacks were not Negroes, but Asiatic African people who once ruled civilization. The group's tiny membership of several hundred followers recognized Elijah Muhammad as Allah's hand-picked messenger, capable of uplifting the black underclass from the depths of poverty, imprisonment, and death. Garvey's promotion of black history and culture found new energies in the nation, but with a twist. Muhammad promoted black political self-determination as part of God's design to restore black people to their former glory. In this sense, the NOI's teachings represented the opposite of the Protestant social gospel, which insisted that religious faith be tied to worldly deeds. The messenger predicted doom for whites, who were characterized as devils for crimes against blacks that stretch from slavery to the present. Malcolm Little's jailhouse conversation in Massachusetts transformed the group. Malcolm's intelligence, wit, and devotion shone through in his correspondence with the messenger, who began to write to him regularly. Over time, Muhammad treated Malcolm as a son, protege, and heir apparent. Malcolm, in turn, credited the messenger for his rehabilitation, editing out Earl Little's role in shaping his political consciousness. Members of the NOI abstained from drugs, alcohol, and extramarital sex. Muhammad's laborers worked multiple jobs, including in NOI businesses, to pay tithes, fees, and special collections to support the messenger's rising standard of living and the group's increasingly grand ambitions. Located primarily in Detroit and Chicago, the nation recruited from the depths of Black America's poor, prisoners, ex-convicts, and drug addicts. After his release from prison, Malcolm quickly traversed the organization's hierarchy through hard work and dogged commitment, rising in a short time to assistant minister and then head minister. In time, Malcolm proved to be Muhammad's most outstanding laborer. He distilled rough truths about racial slavery, black identity, and white supremacy to local temples, black newspapers, and increasingly curious sectors of the black middle class. But he truly excelled as an organizer. If Elijah Muhammad offered a program designed for racial uplift, it would take Malcolm's presence to recruit the flock. The Nation of Islam offered Malcolm his first chance to establish a family since his father's death, but Elijah Muhammad became more than a surrogate father. The NOI's religious iteration of Garvey-styled black nationalism struck a personal chord for Malcolm and his siblings. The organization's strict moral rectitude, regimented behavioral framework, and rigid code of conduct mirrored Earl Little's efforts to politicize his family during their itinerant sojourns through the Midwest. As a child, Malcolm had overlooked Earl's personal transgressions and found strength in the certitude his father displayed when presiding over UNIA political meetings. He searched for most of his life for a black father figure who could replace Earl. Elijah Muhammad became that surrogate father, entering his life at his exact moment of need. Malcolm's projection of black masculinity would be culled from his memories of Earl, his time as a street hustler, and his conversion to Islam. Elijah Muhammad positioned himself as both Allah's messenger on earth and the literal embodiment of the patriarch that, in the eyes of believers, the black community sorely lacked. Malcolm, in turn, revered Muhammad as a surrogate for Earl. Malcolm used his time in Massachusetts State Prison as a religious seminary, a period that became the rough equivalent of Martin Luther King Jr.'s 3-year experience at Crozer Theological Seminary in Chester, Pennsylvania. At Charlestown, Malcolm began to reinvent himself by taking educational classes, reading any book he could find in the small prison library, and generally attending to his intellectual development. Malcolm's siblings frequently visited him, introducing him to the teachings of the Nation of Islam. For Malcolm's extended family, which included 3 children from Earl's first marriage, the NOI offered a chance to restore kinship ties and emotional stability ruptured by divorce, distance, and death. Through the assistance of his sister Ella, Malcolm secured a transfer to the Norfolk Prison Colony in March 1948. Norfolk was more focused on rehabilitation than punishment, providing inmates with open access to books, a debate club, and a newspaper published by prisoners called The Colony. Malcolm devoured the increased educational opportunities afforded him. He began to seriously study black history through the works of African American historians and scholars such as Carter G. Woodson and W.E.B. Du Bois. Their focus on the lost history of black Americans, the reclamation of a proud African identity, and narratives of racial solidarity and political self-determination brought Malcolm closer to Earl's teachings than he had been since he was a child. Malcolm also joined the debate team, quickly earning a reputation as a bold, versatile, and erudite verbal combatant. His favorite subject, criticizing the racial oppression that black people experienced, emerged from reading and personal experience. Malcolm balanced intellectual pursuits with the search for religious conviction. He embraced the Islamic faith as defined by Elijah Muhammad and the Nation with a zeal and energy that surpassed that of the siblings who had introduced him to the religious teachings. Beginning in 1950, Malcolm became adept enough to convert fellow inmates to Islam and emerged as a faith leader and religious activist within the prison. At the start of his 3rd year in Norfolk, he stirred controversy by requesting, in some instances successfully, that officials allow Muslims to follow special dietary restrictions, including no pork, and to relocate to cells in the prison's eastern wing so they could pray in the direction of Mecca. Malcolm, citing religious reasons, also refused to receive a typhoid inoculation, a decision that the deputy superintendent used to facilitate his return to state prison. He would spend just over 2 years back in Charlestown before being paroled on August 7, 1952. After being released, Malcolm set out to become a full-time minister. It would be a short apprenticeship, marked by the dazzling organizing and rhetorical skills he had displayed from the start. By becoming a minister, Malcolm was a rarity in Jim Crow America, a black man who found an enduring profession outside of labor unions, universities, professional schools, or the criminal underworld. Malcolm, like the majority of black men at the time, struggled to find meaningful work until he discovered his passion for the ministry. On parole, he divided his time between his religious training and employment as a dock worker, assembly line laborer, and furniture salesman. Malcolm's prison record listed his past occupations as a dozen working-class jobs: short stints as a waiter, packer, dishwasher, porter, and shoeshine boy, alternated with time as a bartender, warehouse man, and mattress maker. Even after he became a full-time minister, Malcolm remained staunchly opposed to the drudgery and humiliation that often accompanied the lives of black workers who lacked formal education in America. The Nation of Islam had offered him a way out, with the added bonus that he could further develop his precocious intellect. Becoming a minister, for Malcolm, created an avenue to live the life of the mind. Norfolk had served as Malcolm's entree into higher education, and his time on parole became a unique kind of postgraduate work. After prison, Malcolm wanted to make sense of his past. He crafted a narrative, later published in his autobiography, rooted in the truth as he remembered it. The memories that were most distressing revolved around his mistreatment of women. Detroit Red's romantic life, from the perspective of the newly reborn Malcolm X, was littered with emotionally abusive relationships. Malcolm's new surname, X, represented his official entree into the Nation of Islam, which gave members that last name as a symbol of having been stripped of their identity during racial slavery. Malcolm chose to embrace the NOI's rigid gender roles as a balm to heal the childhood wounds caused by the dual traumas of Earl's death and Louise's virtual disappearance from his life. These past hurts were compounded by the ghost of Detroit Red, which he tried to exorcise by becoming the most personally disciplined member to ever join the NOI. He attributed much of the pain he experienced in childhood and as a young man to the failure of morally, economically, or spiritually compromised women. B's betrayal made him publicly disparage the morality of white women. "I got my first schooling about the cesspool morals of the white man from the best possible source, from his own women," he remembered. The Nation of Islam's focus on the restoration of a patriarchal black family, whose loss Malcolm still mourned, resonated deeply. The group's insistence that black women adopt roles as caretakers, teachers, and nurturers of black families and helpmates of black men shaped Malcolm's reinterpretation of his past and his plans for his future. The Nation of Islam served as Malcolm's de facto reentry program. After Malcolm completed his training as a minister, the NOI provided the former convict with a full-time job, a living wage, a car, and a modest home. His position offered him a vocation and the chance for continuing education. He had found his métier. "It was right there in prison," Malcolm recalled years later, "that I made up my mind to devote the rest of my life to telling the white man about himself, or die." His emerging intellectual and political framework identified America as the perpetrator of history's greatest crime, racial slavery, made more heinous by the ongoing denial of black humanity. His personal experience gave him an unsentimental yet intimate portrait of black working class life as an ex-convict, the criminal underworld as a teenage hustler, and the underclass as an adolescent who lived in a series of foster homes. As he gained fame as a minister, Malcolm became a working class hero. His iconic political career took him from Harlem soapboxes to Ivy League campuses, from pilgrimages in the Middle East to meetings with African and Caribbean revolutionaries. Along the way, Malcolm transformed the local, national, and international civil rights landscape by boldly attacking white supremacy, linking contemporary racial injustice to racial slavery, and arguing that only black political self-determination could lead to freedom. Malcolm created new, urgent language that pushed the boundaries of black identity and reimagined American racism as structural, institutional, and global. His rhetoric drew links between domestic civil rights struggles and global anti-colonial movements. Where civil rights activists embraced American democracy, Malcolm explicitly rejected it. "Whenever a Negro fights for democracy, he fighting for something he has not got, never had, and never will have," Malcolm observed in one line of his signature denunciations. When Malcolm X walked out of prison after nearly 7 years on Thursday, August 7, 1952, he entered a Turkish bath to remove the physical feeling of prison taint from his body. He would dedicate the rest of his life to the soul-cleansing work of political activism. He cleansed his body as well, eating only once a day, refraining from pork, and following the diet recommended by the nation's teachings. He moved in with his brother, Wilfred, in Inkster, a majority black suburb of Detroit. He took a series of odd jobs, but spent every spare moment working in the nation's Detroit temple. Over the next 2 years, he would help recruit hundreds of new members. Malcolm met Elijah Muhammad in person for the first time in Chicago, 3 weeks after his release, one of 200 laborers who gathered to hear the messenger speak. In front of a relatively small crowd, the messenger praised Malcolm as a true believer whose daily letters from prison reminded him of the biblical prophet Job. Afterward, Muhammad hosted the little family at his newly purchased Hyde Park mansion, where he instructed his newest follower to focus on recruiting the young, reasoning that older generations would follow through shame. Malcolm X became skilled at fishing for new members, lost souls living in racially segregated ghettos, whom he captivated with lectures combining history, politics, and the nation's religious teachings. He recruited black churchgoers, the formerly incarcerated, young people, the unemployed, and people with good jobs who were still dissatisfied with the pace of racial progress. Malcolm refashioned black nationalist teachings on African pride, black culture, and racial solidarity through a searing critique of white supremacy. "We didn't land on Plymouth Rock, my brothers and sisters," he would regale a crowd. "Plymouth Rock landed on us!" The NOI's admonishment that ministers make it plain enough for ordinary and semi-literate black folk, the originals, who lived on the margins of urban America, reached new depths in Malcolm's penetrating voice. Malcolm observed his first black Muslim service in Detroit, where he served as an assistant minister. Makeupless women wear ankle-length dresses with white scarves covering their hair. Men dressed in simple suits with bow ties, and children seemed unusually well-behaved. "I had never dreamed of anything like that atmosphere among black people, who had learned to be proud they were black," he remembered, "who had learned to love other black people instead of being jealous and suspicious." A typical NOI service included the Islamic flag, depicting a crescent and a star that symbolized the power of the religious faith, which believers equated with freedom, justice, and equality, words emblazoned in chalk beneath the flag at temples. This contrasted with the presentation of the American flag, with the words Christianity, slavery, suffering, and death written below. Muslims sang no religious hymns, but could listen to jazz before a service. Members of the Fruit of Islam, FOI, the nation's security force, rumored to have training in the martial arts and other self-defense techniques, searched all who entered the temple, stood as sentries during services, led the congregation in call and response chants with the minister, and guaranteed an exacting measure of disciplined behavior. At larger gatherings, signs proclaiming, "We must protect our most valuable property, our women," exemplified the patriarchal gender roles that the nation embraced. Muslim women and men were forbidden to engage in unmarried sex. Women were represented in temple leadership as captains of the Muslim Girls Training and General Civilization Class, MGT-GCC, the all-female counterpart of the FOI. Women in the MGT-GCC were taught how to become upstanding Muslims through a 15-point program that banned alcohol, smoking, provocative clothes, pork, and adultery. The nation provided the kind of rigorous physical, intellectual, and spiritual regimen that Malcolm had lost with Earl Little's passing. Malcolm framed black poverty, racial injustice, police brutality, and other social ills politically. On Detroit street corners, the young minister delivered searing public seminars that linked contemporary Jim Crow to the nation's original sin of slavery. He often highlighted sexual violence directed against black women. Rape, to Malcolm, represented an assault, both physical and psychological, that black women endured and that men were helpless to prevent. In vivid, dramatic detail, Malcolm portrayed white society as a criminal syndicate whose anti-black racial violence shaped the 20th century. From the perspective of both Malcolm and black nationalists, black political self-determination meant black men assuming the kind of power over businesses, communities, and families that white supremacy had historically denied them. "I would become so choked up sometimes I would walk in the streets until late into the night," he remembered. "Sometimes I would speak to no one for hours, thinking to myself about what the white man had done to our poor people here in America." Potential recruits felt his passion. He articulated Elijah Muhammad and the nation's message and, in making it his own, innovated a new stream of black political thought and consciousness. Muhammad promoted Malcolm to full-time minister near the end of 1953 and charged his young protege with opening up a new temple in Boston. He completed this task and was transferred to Philadelphia within a few months. In Philadelphia, Malcolm served as the nation's chief political organizer, a position that brought him regional and national visibility. But black Muslims were not the only ones watching. An FBI informant attended one of Malcolm's recruiting meetings in Boston in 1954, the start of the surveillance campaign that would continue for the rest of Malcolm's life. Malcolm spent this time as a roving minister, organizer, and publicist for the NOI, the beginning of his successful rise as a political celebrity who had garnered the attention of law enforcement. The Bureau identified Malcolm's reach as transcending domestic racial politics and emanating out into the larger world. In his speeches, Malcolm argued that indigenous Afro-Asiatic peoples were driving out colonial oppressors, noting that English devils were fleeing even as French devils were being forcibly removed from what was then called Indochina. Not yet 30 years old, Malcolm was sketching out an anti-imperialist critique of American global power, one that reverberated from distant Cold War beachheads to the gritty inner cities of Detroit, Boston, and Philadelphia. Although 1954 was the start of surveillance, the FBI's interest in Malcolm extended back to 1950, when, from prison, he wrote a letter to President Harry Truman opposing the Korean War and reminding the Commander-in-Chief of his efforts to enlist in the Japanese Army during World War II. In 1953, FBI agents personally questioned Malcolm about his failure to register for the Selective Service. He registered shortly after their visit. In the early 1950s, Malcolm looked toward anti-colonial movements in Kenya and Indochina as the dawn of a new age. By the middle of that decade, his position had crystallized. The treatment of African Americans, he said, was the yardstick by which all dark nations of Earth measured white American attitudes toward race. According to Malcolm, America's treatment of people of color, both national and global, reverberated, offering powerful ammunition to the struggles at home and abroad. Throughout the 1950s and 60s, Malcolm's audience grew beyond the confines of the Northeast, bursting into the South and across international borders. Malcolm carried a message wide and deep enough to attract a global constituency that dwarfed the relatively small number of black Muslims he converted. Malcolm X arrived in Harlem in June 1954, just weeks after the watershed Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court decision formally outlawed racial segregation. Harlem both benefited from and contributed to the political stirrings of the moment via a rich history of activism that the youthful Malcolm Little had caught only glimpses of during the war years. In Harlem, Malcolm became minister of Temple No. 7 on West 116th Street. He found himself competing with veteran street speakers, seasoned black nationalists, venerable Garveyites, and long-admired radicals of various ideological backgrounds. Beyond grassroots activists celebrating black pride was a class of powerful elected officials, including Manhattan Borough President Hulan Jack and the legendary Congressman Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who presided over the 15,000-strong Abyssinian Baptist Church. Powell and Malcolm became allies and occasional adversaries, jockeying for Harlem's attention. But whereas one translated tough talk on racial justice into votes that could be leveraged in Congress, the other set out to win hearts and minds. Powell had a well-deserved reputation for late-night carousing and outspoken candor against racial injustice. He was a hero among his Harlem constituents. The most well-known black elected official in America, Powell represented a militant yet pragmatic brand of black politics. More established than Malcolm and the nation, Powell embraced the aspects of their rhetoric that touched the beating heart of black ghettos around the nation. Malcolm and Powell both identified themselves as authentic representatives of the black community, and Powell instantly recognized the younger activist as an emerging talent and cultivated him as a potential rival for political leadership. He invited Malcolm to speak at Abyssinian Baptist, fully aware of his public criticism of Christianity. Malcolm denied rumors that he wanted Powell's congressional seat with measured support, noting that while the Harlem congressman has done a good job, he could do a much better job. He later confided to Powell, "You don't get any money from white people. It's all black money. That's it, Adam. That's why I love you." Malcolm's sermons indicated Christianity as culpable in America's original sin of racial slavery and its continued perpetuation by another name, under Jim Crow. He personalized this denunciation by resurrecting the ghost of Detroit Red. "I was a typical Christian Negro, buried up to my neck in the mud of this filthy world, with very little hope, desire, or intention of amounting to anything." Malcolm imagined Christianity as a religion invented and practiced by white people who enslaved his ancestors and used the Bible to justify centuries of racial oppression. The Islamic flag and the contrasting American flag lent visual power to Malcolm's denunciation of America as a searing wilderness of racial turmoil, oppression, and injustice. Malcolm's speaking style, which combined the fervor of a Baptist preacher with the brio of a Harlem street speaker, helped mold a new generation of ministers, the most exceptional being Louis Eugene Walcott, a college graduate and calypso singer whose parents, like Malcolm's, had been disciples of Marcus Garvey. Louis X, as he would be known before rising to fame as Louis Farrakhan, first encountered Malcolm in Boston and quickly became one of his most fervent admirers. The Nation of Islam attracted black artists, intellectuals, and performers who felt stymied by Jim Crow, impatient with the pace of racial change and disillusioned with the Christian beliefs espoused in mainstream black churches. Malcolm's youthful love of jazz and bebop and friendships with popular artists and musicians of the 1940s made him comfortable around cultural and literary figures. His outreach to New York City's leading black artists and intellectuals stretched the limits of acceptable behavior within the nation, which disdained entertainers. James Baldwin became one of Malcolm's biggest supporters. Less than a year older than Malcolm, the Harlem-born Baldwin joined America's Civil Rights Front after years living in a self-imposed Parisian exile, trying to escape the specter of racial discrimination. After a detour through post-war literary circles, Baldwin finally came to the racial justice struggle back in Harlem. He reinvented himself as a literary firebrand, prolific essayist, and civil rights champion whose wide circle of politically active friends included both Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. Malcolm also purposefully established alliances with influential black journalists. James Hicks of the New York Amsterdam News, William Worthy of the Baltimore Afro-American, and reporter Louis Lomax were some of his key interlocutors. The black press, populated by important outlets such as the Los Angeles Herald-Dispatch, Pittsburgh Courier, and Chicago Defender, shaped sympathetic coverage of the Nation of Islam in a way that white periodicals never could. These newspapers did not condemn the group as hate mongers or reverse racists. Instead, they approached the Nation of Islam as part of the wide spectrum of black religious and political organizations that historically sought to carve a space of autonomy within an unrepentantly racist nation. In a historical environment indelibly shaped by Jim Crow, black newspapers framed African American public opinion in a manner unseen before or since. Malcolm's growing fame placed him within a long history of black radicalism in Harlem. Harlem radicalism stretched back to the days of the passionately erudite socialist street speaker and organizer Hubert Harrison, who helped introduce Marcus Garvey to new audiences. The neighborhood's legendary renaissance promoted artistic rebellion as the cultural arm of a political revolution that seemed to sputter just as it began to truly soar. Glimpses of the glorious days of the New Negroes, whose literary exploits briefly turned Harlem into an avant-garde paradise of interracial bonhomie, could be seen in the scattered remnants of black writers and artists who would reclaim an identity once thought to be lost by befriending Malcolm X. From Muslim mosques in Harlem and Philadelphia, Malcolm articulated the disillusionment of these intellectuals by comparing the violence and degradation of Jim Crow to slavery. A keen observer of the civil rights struggle, he held up photos of black activists being brutalized in Mississippi as proof of the depths of white supremacy. Malcolm confided to NOI members that he resisted fighting in World War II and the Korean War as a conscientious objector, noting the irony in blacks willing to go all over the world and fight on behalf of whites, while refusing to go around the corner to fight for their own people. The April 1955 Afro-Asian Conference in Bandung, Indonesia, introduced the Non-Aligned Movement, a powerful alternative to the claustrophobic dictates of the Cold War. led by Indonesian President Sukarno and the prime ministers of India, Pakistan, Burma, and Ceylon, the conference framed Asian and African nations as independent. They made history by refusing to join Western democracies or communist blocs, opting instead for a non-aligned movement where indigenous people would shape their own future. Representatives from majority Muslim countries, including Saudi Arabia, Syria, Lebanon, Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq, attended. The gathering, which featured 29 world leaders representing over 1 billion people, reimagined the global North and South, elevating what would be called the Third World as a major player in world affairs. Malcolm read about Bandung in the press and drew instant inspiration. Immediately after the conference, Malcolm began touting the gathering and its importance to Black power. Malcolm's expansive definition of Black unity, forged through a shared history of racial oppression, took shape through the prism of Bandung's reimagining of the Third World. He conceived of radical Black dignity as a kind of global citizenship based on a daring combination of human rights and political self-determination, backed by the collective power of billions. Malcolm insisted that Black people were part of a larger group of darker nations capable of transforming the world if they were brave enough to identify with his vision. Malcolm X saw, in Bandung's display of political unity, a vision of a liberated future stretching from Africa to America. Racial oppression within the United States, from Harlem to Los Angeles, would continue as long as Black political activists remained divided over strategies, tactics, and ideology. The NOI, Malcolm surely knew, contributed to these divisions with its talk of racial Armageddon, dire predictions of the fall of American empire, and racially provocative allegations that whites were predisposed toward anti-Black violence. To combat this, Malcolm dreamed of convening a Bandung conference in Harlem. He was convinced that a conference of his own could unify Black leaders toward the creation of a militant movement for racial justice. Bandung helped Malcolm to appreciate the global dimensions of political oppression and the necessity of solidarity that transcended religious and political differences in service of liberation. He championed the gathering's willingness to convene across ideological and political differences, an example he yearned to follow in his own organizing. Malcolm's success in modernizing the Nation of Islam impressed Elijah Muhammad. In 1956, Muhammad approved the purchase of a brand new Chevrolet for Malcolm's personal use. Malcolm estimated that in 5 months, he drove that car 30,000 miles across the nation during fishing expeditions. The gift of a car proved to be a prelude for a far more significant promotion. In 1957, Muhammad named Malcolm the NOI's national representative. Muhammad recognized that Malcolm's impact grew as more people were exposed to his particular message. His ability to win converts, build new temples, fundraise, and extol the power of Muhammad made him the nation's most important recruit since the messenger himself. As the NOI's national representative, Malcolm X became the public face of the organization. He projected an image of almost superhuman vitality, masking the effects of a punishing, around-the-clock travel and work schedule, which came to a head in October. That month, Malcolm entered Sydenham Hospital in Harlem after experiencing chest pains that mimicked a heart attack. Doctors diagnosed Malcolm with stress and released him after 2 days. But his hectic pace would only increase with the passage of time. The stress of becoming Malcolm X, advocate and champion of radical Black dignity, took a private toll not witnessed by the public during these years. Malcolm joined the nation's inner circle while courting 23-year-old Betty X, formerly Sanders, a nurse who attended Temple No. 7, but their relationship faced several considerable obstacles. The year before they met, Malcolm experienced a brief engagement to Evelyn Williams, a past love from his Detroit Red days who joined the nation after he did. He broke this engagement under pressure from the messenger to remain unencumbered from a family, to better devote his energies to building the nation. Many friends thought that Malcolm loved Evelyn and never truly recovered from her loss, but Malcolm also considered the prospect of marriage to be a potential liability. He often generalized women as treacherous, disloyal, and selfish. He wanted a wife who would conform to the instructions set forth in MGT GCC classes. He found this in Betty. During fishing expeditions, he gave panoramic seminars about the black community's inability to defend the family, and Malcolm promised to protect beautiful black women from racist abuse within the secure confines of the nation. He charged white society with denigrating black women during slavery, where pregnant women were forced to work in the fields almost to the point of delivery, and the women who did not keep up their work were whipped. But a duality existed in Malcolm's understanding of gendered violence. He viewed historic assaults against women as illustrating a shameful lack of patriarchal authority and black male power in America. While he blamed white men for these crimes, he also held black women accountable for what he saw as their willingness to imbibe the worst aspects of Western society, a world that mocked black men's intelligence, power, and authority. From this perspective, the perceived dysfunction of the black family could be attributed to black women who became unwitting tools of white supremacy by resisting the teachings of the Nation of Islam. Steeped in these views, Malcolm was unprepared for the kind of deep intimacy that represented the hallmark of a strong marital relationship. After his 1958 wedding to Betty, Malcolm tended to see her as an extension of his political work, expecting her to be dutiful, loyal, and an attentive mother and homemaker. It was an often painful union, and Malcolm, like his father, was frequently absent, devoting much more to professional ambitions than home life. While Malcolm would struggle to establish a happy familial life, he excelled at projecting black solidarity publicly. As national representative, he reached out to Harlem's most important black church and its most powerful elected official. From Congressman Powell's pulpit at Abyssinian Baptist, Malcolm facilitated an unprecedented display of religious unity, proclaiming the nation's solidarity with the black Christian community it had previously denounced. Referring to Muslims and Christians alike as brothers, Malcolm challenged Abyssinian parishioners to recognize a shared political and racial solidarity. Black unity, Malcolm argued, meant black power, citing Harlem as the key spot to elect a governor or mayor or anyone you want, an admission of the power of black voting rights. On the last Friday of April 1957, NOI member Johnson X. Hinton witnessed police officers beating a black man on 125th Street and Lenox Avenue in Harlem. Hinton and a group of NOI members intervened. "You're not in Alabama," they reportedly told police. "This is New York." Police arrested Hinton and then brutally beat his face, head, and shins with nightsticks. A series of standoffs occurred between police and almost 2,000 community activists outraged at Hinton's brutal treatment. Battle lines shifted between the 123rd Street Police Station and Harlem Hospital, where Hinton was treated for a fractured skull, head lacerations, and blood clots in his brain. Coverage of the events labeled Malcolm X as the group's spiritual leader, a turn of phrase that anticipated the emerging competition between the messenger and his protege, and further catapulted Malcolm from local activist to national political figure within the black community. Hospital officials transferred the gravely injured Hinton back to the 123rd Street police station. Malcolm and thousands of others followed. Standing outside the police station, dressed in suits, overcoats, and hats, the NOI projected the appearance of an unarmed military unit awaiting orders. Behind the men were rows of Muslim women, heads covered, standing erect and impassive. The scene outside 123rd Street was cinematic, and the few dozen NOI members were joined by thousands of Harlem residents murmuring about the latest case of police brutality. Malcolm successfully pressured police officials into letting him see Hinton. Blood cascaded from the top of his head down his shoulders. "That man belongs in the hospital," Malcolm said to the lieutenant in charge. Dressed elegantly in a two-piece suit, camel hair coat, fedora, and glasses, Malcolm led tense negotiations with police officials in an effort to save Hinton's life and calm the crowd outside, which was simmering with rage over a long history of police violence. New York's deputy police commissioner agreed to transfer Hinton back to the hospital for treatment. The crowd followed. Rows of Muslims walked along Lenox Avenue, one of Harlem's main boulevards, and stood vigil outside of Harlem Hospital. Police officials approached Malcolm for the second time that evening, asking him to help defuse another standoff threatening to erupt in violence. Malcolm demurred, telling police that Muslims were standing peacefully, disciplined perfectly, and harming no one. The police conceded as much, but expressed fear of the hundreds who gathered behind the Muslims, unsupervised Harlem residents who answered to no one. "I politely told him those others were his problem," Malcolm recalled. When Malcolm was allowed into the hospital to see Hinton, he turned to the crowd and, with a single wave of his hand, dispersed the Muslim battalion, with bystanders soon following. New York Amsterdam News editor James Hicks stood next to a deputy police inspector as the scene unfolded. "Mr. Hicks," the inspector reportedly said, "that's too much power for one man to have." Police released Hinton the next day, 16 hours after sustaining the original injuries. A group of NOI members rushed him to Harlem's Sydenham Hospital. Doctors gave him even odds of recovering. 400 NOI members from as far as Baltimore, Boston, Hartford, Wilmington, and Washington, D.C. stood vigil at a nearby park awaiting word. On the Monday that followed, April 29th, as Hinton's life hung in the balance, Malcolm negotiated with police officials. Police agreed to investigate the allegations of brutality in exchange for a promise that the NOI would not retaliate in the streets. Hinton survived, and a grand jury declined to indict him on charges of disorderly conduct and resisting arrest, but the ordeal involved multiple surgeries that left Hinton with a metal plate in his head and physical and psychological wounds that never fully healed. In the aftermath of the Hinton incident, Malcolm served as the quasi-spokesperson for Black New Yorkers abused by the criminal justice system. The New York Police Department's tense relationship with the Black community tested Malcolm's hypothesis about the merits of racial solidarity. Malcolm thought if Black New Yorkers were unified politically, they could forge a power base strong enough to end police brutality and mistreatment forever. He now viewed the fight to eradicate police brutality and gain equal treatment from the justice system as an extension of the nation's prison ministry, a mission he had actively benefited from and joined while incarcerated. The fervor over Hinton's treatment created a buzz that amplified the profile of Elijah Muhammad and the NOI. The nation's message of political self-determination, dignity, and self-help put the organization forth as an all-Black alternative to local civil rights groups. Malcolm fervently believed this, while the messenger most certainly did not. Muhammad remained committed to the religious rather than political aspects of the group, but enjoyed the benefits of Malcolm's growing success. This tension was manageable so long as Malcolm's skirmishes into racial justice politics provided more benefits than liabilities. The beating of Johnson X. Hinton and the vigils and negotiations that followed were important demonstrations of Malcolm X's political leadership. Without ever acknowledging as much, Malcolm led a nonviolent demonstration that amplified the Nation of Islam's power in New York City and showcased the potential for Muslims to work as power brokers and political players in Harlem, especially in work related to the criminal justice system's treatment of Black Americans. During the incident, a police officer had pointed at Malcolm and said, "We should break that bastard's head because he is their leader." Indeed, Malcolm's work during that critical weekend in April elevated his standing from the sectarian confines of the NOI to the wider arena of racial struggle that marked Black life in Harlem. Malcolm became a folk hero on the same streets where he had once run wild in his youth. Malcolm's relationship with the Black press proved to be key here. Most important, in Harlem, the world's most heavily populated Black ghetto, the New York Amsterdam News made the whole story headline news, Malcolm recalled. And for the first time, the Black man, woman, and child in the streets were discussing those Muslims. So were the police, who took keen interest in the group's activities. During the first week of May, NYPD officers conducted a warrantless search of Temple No. 7, and Malcolm spotted officers filming NOI members as they entered religious services. he accused police of attempting to embarrass and intimidate congregants in retaliation for standing up for their dignity in the Hinton case. Malcolm's knack for public relations was transformative. 5 years after Malcolm's release from prison, the Nation of Islam had grown from a marginal group of roughly 400, primarily in Chicago and Detroit, into a small but formidable part of the political and cultural landscape in major American cities, with membership numbering in the thousands. By 1957, Malcolm was authoring a weekly column, God's Angry Men, for the New York Amsterdam News, and had facilitated The Messenger publishing a weekly column in the same paper. Malcolm's column, friendships with black journalists, and networks within the national black press inspired him to start planning for an NOI newspaper, Muhammad Speaks, which he envisioned being filled with Nation of Islam news. Malcolm oversaw the nation's growth through his recruiting efforts, oversight of new temples, and identification and cultivation of a new generation of Muslim leaders, including Joseph X. Gravitt, a military veteran rescued from alcoholism and a volatile temper by Malcolm and Louis X. Joseph would serve alongside of Malcolm in the nation's Harlem Mosque as captain of the Fruit of Islam, the group's paramilitary security force. FOI's sentries guarded against internal and external forces, policing the boundaries of the nation's mosques for violations of protocol as minor as failing to pay regular dues or as major as drinking alcohol or taking drugs. Punishments range from verbal warnings and temporary suspensions to physical violence and expulsion. Louis X became the minister of the Boston Temple and one of Malcolm's closest confidants, a devoted acolyte driven by a sincere belief in the messenger, deep admiration of Malcolm, and personal ambition to make his mark within the organization. Ella Mae Collins returned to the NOI fold via the Boston Temple, a circumstance that both pleased and surprised Malcolm, who considered his sister to be perhaps the most formidable person, besides Earl, he had ever met. In practical effect, Malcolm X modernized the Nation of Islam. By 1955, NOI membership had increased to almost 6,000 members. By 1961, it had surged to over 50,000. With the glaring exception of Elijah Muhammad's family, positions of leadership were based on talent and hard work. Malcolm possessed a jeweler's eye for spotting potential within neglected parts of the black community. He utilized the media to build a personal and organizational following. At his core, Malcolm X was a diplomat, even as he cultivated a public following as a bold oracle of racial militancy. Behind the scenes, he could chat amiably with political adversaries as if they were close supporters and friends. Malcolm's organizing abilities buttressed his rhetorical swagger, and his reach extended as far south as Georgia. During a southern campaign trip as part of a national speaking tour in the summer of 1957, Malcolm founded Atlanta's Temple No. 15. In the summer of 1958, 13,000 people listened to Elijah Muhammad at Uline Arena in Washington, D.C., the crowd overflowing into a nearby park, a vacant lot, and the streets. It was a display of organizational strength and political power that would have been unimaginable before Malcolm joined the NOI. In Washington, Malcolm's description of Muhammad as the one man capable of bringing black people together obscured his own indispensable role in such triumphant moments. The messenger entrusted Malcolm with mounting organizational responsibilities, even as members of his family began smearing the young prince as a potential usurper, and Muhammad's inner circle remained fearful that Malcolm might grow too powerful. Malcolm's organizing prowess solidified his position within the NOI and helped to shape the public identity of both the nation and himself. He defined his religious beliefs through political commentary and analysis of racial injustice in America and around the world. He came to view radical dignity as a political and ideological platform that could organize global black power against the pervasive forces of white supremacy. Ultimately, his aims of confronting American democracy's jagged edges, challenging police brutality, advocating for self-defense and racial pride, and calling out the use of American power internationally would loom even larger than the thousands of new recruits who poured into the nation. Malcolm's words of fire inspired black activists outside of the group, serving to radicalize mainstream civil rights discourse. Black leaders critical of Malcolm's position privately conceded that he correctly diagnosed America's racial illness, even as they attacked his cure as perhaps worse than the disease. Chapter 2. The Radical Citizenship of Martin Luther King. Throughout the late 1950s, Malcolm X found himself responding to a political landscape shaped by Martin Luther King Jr. King's political mobilization of Southern Negroes in Montgomery, Alabama, reverberated nationally. While Malcolm made inroads in the South through the establishment of Muslim mosques in Atlanta and Florida, King took command from the pulpit of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery. Dexter represented the church of big Negroes, college-educated professionals, doctors, lawyers, and entrepreneurs flocked to the church and its 26-year-old Negro preacher with a doctoral degree from Boston University. Born on January 15, 1929, in Atlanta, Georgia, as Michael Luther King Jr., King grew up safely ensconced in the world of the black elite, his childhood free of the tragedy that would shape Malcolm X. By the time Mike, as friends called him, turned 5 years old, his father, Michael, changed both of their names following a trip to the Baptist World Alliance in Berlin. King Sr., the highest paid black minister in Atlanta, toured Europe and the Middle East and returned to Georgia to a welcome featured on the front page of the Atlanta Daily World. Martin Luther King Sr. came from humble sharecropping origins around Stockbridge, Georgia. Daddy King, as he came to be known to friends and family, reinvented himself as a preacher, marrying Alberta Williams, the daughter of one of Atlanta's most successful black pastors, A.D. Williams. After Williams' death, King Sr. presided over his congregation at Ebenezer Baptist, becoming a leading race man, the affectionate name for black leaders who advocated racial uplift against the backdrop of white supremacy. King Jr., along with his younger brother A.D. and older sister Christine, grew up in Atlanta's segregated black elite. Public accommodations were rigidly policed, and even the children of the black bourgeoisie encountered racial assaults. King's awareness of racial inequality came at an early age. When he was 8 years old, he received a sharp slap in the face from a white woman who accused him of stepping on her foot. Daddy King forcefully resisted the indignities of Atlanta's Jim Crow system, something that young Martin witnessed and admired. King Sr. refused to ride Atlanta's segregated buses. He never answered to the denigrating term boy that whites used to refer to adult black men. And, in King's recollection, he once stood up to a police officer after a traffic stop by pointedly identifying himself as Reverend King. Like Malcolm X, King revered his Baptist preaching father, a man comfortable enough to tell black parishioners to embrace political self-determination. "I am going to move forward toward freedom, and I'm hoping everybody here today joins me," King Sr. declared before 1,000 people attending a 1939 rally at Ebenezer. Young ML, as friends called him, worshiped Daddy King as a man of real integrity, deeply committed to moral and ethical principles, an image that shaped his professional and intellectual aspirations. As the son of a preacher, King wrestled with his own faith. He experienced doubts about God's beneficence following the unexpected death of his grandmother, and Atlanta's race relations filled him with resentment for whites throughout his youth. At 10, King watched in horror and fascination at the city's Christmastime showing of the film Gone with the Wind. The festivities included a downtown parade replete with Confederate flags, and thousands of Atlanta's white residents crammed into Lowe's Grand Theater to enjoy the film's romantic depiction of antebellum slavery. King's discomfort with the film's nostalgic portrayal of white supremacy, which included Academy Award-winning actress Hattie McDaniel's role as Scarlett O'Hara's black mammy caretaker and Butterfly McQueen's performance as the anxious, loud, and not-too-intelligent house servant Prissy, mirrored that of 14-year-old Malcolm Little, who watched the film in Mason, Michigan. "I was the only Negro in the theater," Malcolm remembered, "and when Butterfly McQueen went into her act, I felt like crawling under the rug." King's encounters with racism in popular culture were mediated through his personal experience. He was acutely aware of the ways that blacks were forced to degrade themselves. At 6, he lost his white best friend to the harsh discipline of racial segregation. At 14, he was forced to remain standing on a 90-mile bus trip from Atlanta to Dublin, Georgia. Black passengers were forced to move once white passengers boarded. "It was the angriest I have ever been in my life," King recalled. King both admired and feared his father, whose discipline included whippings until King turned 15. He spent the summer before college working on a tobacco farm in Simsbury, Connecticut, which allowed him access to integrated travel between New York and Washington, an experience he came to relish. After that summer, when he returned to the Jim Crow South, "The very idea of separation did something to my sense of dignity and self-respect," he later remembered. He enrolled at the historically black Morehouse College, the most prestigious 4-year men's school in the nation. King matched a precocious intellect with a burgeoning sense of himself as a potential agent of social change. Dr. Benjamin Mays, Morehouse's distinguished president and a friend of Daddy King, was an intellectual who believed in social justice and helped imbue an ethic of leadership as service. He became one of King's mentors and role models. Religious classes with Dr. George Kelsey offered a scholarly entree into the study of Christianity, which King longed for as an antidote to what he regarded as the emotionalism, kicking, stomping, and verbally praising the Lord, that he encountered in the Black Baptist Church, a tradition that Daddy King exemplified. King dressed well, and his love of fine clothes earned him the nickname Tweedy. He pursued romantic relationships with the daughters of Atlanta's black elite. Despite his average height, King presented as a good catch, with his baritone voice making him stand out as mature beyond his years. At Morehouse, King's reputation as a ladies' man earned him great admiration from male students, who called King and his friend Larry Williams the Wreckers, in honor of their dating exploits. King's plans to study medicine and then law were scuttled by a growing interest in the intersection of race, religion, and justice. On August 6, 1946, while Malcolm X spent his first year as a fish in Charlestown State Prison, King wrote a letter, "Kick Up Dust," published in the Atlanta Constitution. He wrote the letter against the backdrop of the murders of 2 black couples and 1 black man, Maceo Snipes, by whites in Georgia. Both cases made national news. Snipes' killing especially galled King. Snipes had cast the sole black vote in Taylor County and was killed the next day for his courage. "We want and are entitled to the basic rights and opportunities of American citizens," wrote 17-year-old King. He accused white racists of bringing up interracial intimacy as an excuse to deny black citizenship. "We aren't eager to marry white girls, and we would like to have our own girls left alone by both white toughs and white aristocrats." The letter exemplified young King's racial militancy and a pride and confidence in black history, rooted in the political example he saw at home, encountered at Morehouse, and dreamed of carrying forth into the world. He spent his first 3 years at Morehouse resisting Daddy King's pleas to join the ministry. In 1947, he finally relented. At 18, King passed his trial sermon at Ebenezer Baptist Church. That same year, King wrote an essay in the Morehouse newspaper chiding his classmates for aspiring to be middle-class black elites who used their education to forever trample upon the masses. It proved to be an early example of King's criticism of the capitalist economic system. In his final year in college, he served as Daddy King's assistant pastor, something that pleased his father to no end. He also penned a campus newspaper article, "The Purpose of Education," that criticized Georgia's former governor, Eugene Talmadge, for his segregationist views. King took further steps into the public arena by joining, over Daddy King's objections, a council of interracial students from area colleges. His budding relationships across the color line made him view many white persons as allies, particularly among the younger generation. Morehouse President Benjamin Mays chose King as class speaker for the senior sermon, where he dazzled his classmates during the mandatory chapel service. After graduating from Morehouse, King spent 3 years at Crozer Theological Seminary in Chester, Pennsylvania. The school's location, close to Philadelphia and removed from the domineering Daddy King, drew him closer to crafting a personal religious philosophy that connected with his interest in social justice. He joined 9 other black students in a class of 32, a surprising diversity for a prestigious, typically white school. The surprises didn't end there. A pool room beneath the seminary chapel became a fixture where certain students, including King, congregated. At Crozer, King discovered, analyzed, and came to embrace the social gospel through reading the work of Walter Rauschenbusch, the theologian and author of Christianity and the Social Crisis. The social gospel interpreted Christ's teachings as a vehicle for social justice on earth, not just in heaven. Rauschenbusch examined Christianity through the prism of social ethics, arguing that social justice on earth reflected the greatest manifestation of God's love, and King immediately gravitated toward this perspective. Crozer attracted an eclectic faculty of religious scholars, intellectuals, and freethinkers who challenged, fascinated, and inspired King. He studied the writings of Mahatma Gandhi and Karl Marx, and although he was more intrigued by Marx, he would come to be permanently associated with Gandhi. King rejected the evils of communism, which he defined as the ideology's metaphysical materialism, an ethical relativism, and a strangulating totalitarianism, while paying close attention to its critique of economic injustice and social inequality. When King read Gandhi, the philosophical concept of satyagraha, roughly translated to truth force or love force, held particular appeal for him, as his experiences with Jim Crow had previously convinced him that nothing short of an armed revolt would bring about racial justice. King regarded Gandhi's nonviolent movement against British colonialism in India as the collective application of Jesus' love, one capable of inspiring a powerful and effective social force on a large scale. As he studied these thinkers, King was seeking a religious and political philosophy that deplored poverty while recognizing love, democracy, and justice as sacred principles. In his first term at Crozer, King wrote a paper outlining the obligation he felt to personally address unemployment, ghettos, and economic insecurity. King felt that preachers should possess profundity of conviction and spellbinding oratory. One absent, the other produced spiritual impoverishment. He viewed the role of preaching ministry as a dual process, wherein he labored to inspire his flock to transform society so that the individual soul will have a change. King applied himself to his seminary studies, reporting to his mother, "I never go anywhere much but these books." Although he was more serious about academics at seminary than he had been at Morehouse, King slightly overstated his dedication. He found plenty of time to cultivate a new community of friends, colleagues, and mentors that extended from Chester to Philadelphia to New York. He attended regular dinners at the home of Pastor J. Pius Barber, a King family friend and Crozer's first black graduate. Reverend Barber served many roles for King: a confidant about romantic entanglements, a debating partner on racial justice issues, and a mentor whose family became a second home for King throughout his time at Crozer. King also took advantage of the natural beauty that surrounded the seminary. Each afternoon, he enjoyed long walks to the edge of campus, where a tributary from the Delaware River ran. His efforts to commune with nature reflected a deeply meditative side of his personality that he would struggle to cultivate alongside growing demands on his time. King discovered Reinhold Niebuhr's 1932 classic, Moral Man and a Moral Society, during his final year at Crozer, and the book offered him a blueprint for his transition from a preacher with intellectual ambitions to a faith leader and public intellectual undergirded by a belief that justice is love's message for the collective mind. Niebuhr turned King inside out. The theologian's skepticism toward the social gospel, Marxism, and liberalism forced King to re-examine his own views. Niebuhr identified power as the necessary adjunct to moral transformation. He judged nonviolent methods as more important for their ability to alter oppressive regimes than for their romantic interpretations, such as those associated with Gandhi. The study of Niebuhr gave King the tools to confront evil that existed beyond intellectual comprehension in service of challenging political problems that required moral courage. In 1950, while Malcolm X made intellectual strides at Norfolk Prison Colony and fomented protests for better prison conditions, King came into his own at Crozer as a budding scholar, precocious speaker, and student leader of weekly devotionals. He was elected student body president during his second year, making him the first black person to win that honor. King's time in Chester exposed him to both the opportunities and the limits of integration. He socialized with white students and fell in love with Betty Moitz, the white daughter of Crozer's dietitian. He dated Betty while seeing other women in Chester, Philadelphia, and New York, continuing a pattern of womanizing that began at Morehouse. He toyed with the possibility of marrying Betty until the pressure from friends and mentors, who insisted that the relationship would place too great a burden on his future ambitions, convinced him not to. His dating life wasn't the only troubled aspect of his time at Crozer. As a young seminarian, his essays illustrated a sharp mind but sloppy writing. He unevenly credited the source of his work, only occasionally attributed the words of others, and produced papers that would have constituted plagiarism if checked more thoroughly. These problems would continue to haunt him throughout his academic career, but both the secret romance with Betty and his plagiarism would remain undiscovered during his lifetime. King grew more intellectually ambitious and politically confident during his years at Crozer. He delivered dozens of lectures in churches in Chester and Philadelphia and audited a graduate seminar on ethics and philosophy of history at the University of Pennsylvania. The importance of Gandhi was reinforced for him after listening to a speech by Howard University President Mordecai Johnson in Philadelphia in 1950. Fresh from a trip to India the previous year, the outspoken Johnson railed against Christianity's complicity with Jim Crow and compared the British treatment of Indians to the way America treated colored citizens in Alabama and Mississippi. King also continued to develop a skepticism toward American capitalism. "I am convinced," King wrote in early 1951, "that capitalism has seen its best days." His disapproval stemmed from his deepening empathy for the poor and political underdogs. "Since capitalism has failed to meet the needs of the masses," he reasoned, "it would be replaced by an unconscious move towards social democracy." His embrace of a socialist model contrasted with Daddy King, a fervid capitalist who blanched at his son's leftward political drift. Father and son discussed, debated, and argued about economic justice. Daddy King found himself talking to a young man repudiating the basics of capitalism and Western democracy in favor of a more redistributive social and economic system. King, in contrast to Malcolm, continuously encountered black men who served as professional and intellectual mentors. Morehouse President Mays, Reverend Barber in Chester, and Daddy King remained his son's North Star and primary source of inspiration. But despite his deep love for his father, King found his own political, theological, and personal voice during his years at seminary. When his father came to visit, King played pool and smoked cigarettes in front of him, behavior that would previously have drawn harsh rebuke. In sermons at Ebenezer during the summers, King tested out political themes he had encountered at Crozer. He used his deep baritone, crisp diction, and southern drawl to find a rhetorical middle ground between the fire and brimstone Baptist preachers like his father and the white ministers, including some of his professors, whose academic preaching style left him cold. King graduated from Crozer on May 15, 1951. He received a $1,200 fellowship to pursue graduate studies, as well as another honor given to the school's equivalent of a valedictorian. Named the most outstanding student out of his class of 10 seminarians, King left Crozer with a deeper sense of his intellectual identity and a clearer idea of the kind of preacher he longed to be. If Malcolm X found intellectual, religious, and personal validation in a New England prison, King found similar affirmation in a northern seminary, where he studied a wide range of thinkers and befriended white students and professors. he left Chester with plans to move temporarily further north rather than return to Atlanta. Instead, he secured a scholarship to Boston University to pursue a doctorate in the philosophy of religion. With no steady girlfriend, King had continued to cultivate a reputation as a ladies' man. But in Boston, he met and fell in love with Coretta Scott, a classically trained singer, 2 years older than the 22-year-old doctoral student on scholarship at the city's New England Conservatory of Music. King bluntly informed Coretta that he was seeking a wife who possessed character, intelligence, personality, and beauty. "You have them all," he told her. He called her Corey, and she called him Martin. They married in her native Alabama, just outside of Selma, less than 18 months after their first date. Coretta proved to be far more of a match than King could have imagined or anticipated. But even as he cast harsh judgment on Daddy King's unrepentant capitalism and the moral evil that gripped much of the world, King personally reveled in the masculine privileges of his social class. He expected a sexual fidelity and loyalty from Coretta that he would never offer in exchange. It was a complicated relationship, and their early romance eventually flowered